From Pacifica Radio, this is Democracy Now! Robert Dole takes New York and heads due south for Super Tuesday. On this International Women's Day, we speak with three women activists from New York, former Congressmember Bella Abzug. She's just issued a contract with American Women. From India, anti-GATT activist Vandana Shiva responds to the latest mega-merger of Ciba Geigy and Sandoz Pharmaceutical Company.
No matter how big the giant corporations are, they are too small for the logic of growth. And therefore, they are in as much a struggle for survival as are the poor peasants and the tribals and the indigenous people and the poor blacks in downtown ghettos. They too are in a struggle for survival, and this is part of their struggle for survival, except that they're surviving in the environment of greed, whereas the rest of the world has to survive in an environment of need.
And from the Bronx, youth activist Ana Maria Nieves. Her message, do something. All that and more coming up on Democracy Now! Welcome to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman. Well, Senator Bob Dole steamrolled through New York and turned due south for Super Tuesday contests against Pat Buchanan and Steve Forbes. His remaining rivals brushed aside pointed entreaties from Dole after his impressive New York showing yesterday to direct their fire at President Clinton. But Buchanan continues his attacks on Dole, labeling him the biggest taxer in the history of the Republican Party. Forbes says Dole is usurping his ideas about a simplified tax code. Yesterday, Dole snared all 93 delegates at stake here in New York, even though more than half of those voting, according to exit polls, feel that the Senate leader lacks new ideas. Forbes spent more than $2 million on the New York race, but it turns out after a recount that he didn't win a single delegate. Pat Buchanan largely ignored New York and was shut out in the hunt for delegates. Dole's New York showing brought his national delegate total to 382. Forbes has 72, Buchanan 62, with 996 needed to clinch the nomination. For a bit of reaction to the New York primary, but more importantly, some creative opposition and creative thoughts and ideas that are being put forward by women around this country, we're going to turn next to former Congressmember Bella Abzug. But before we do that, we wanted to share a little of this.
I got a TV, looks in time. Across the planets to where you can find a reincarnate U.S. of A, which enjoys a certain shift of focus, you might say. Choice is a given, and it's so fact. Chief Justice Barbara Jordan's got a handle on that. And when the band plays Hail to the Chief, President Abzug appears on the screen. Bella, kudos to her, top of the morning, top of the world, the stars and stripes, the red, white, and blue, President Abzug, here's to you.
Well, President Abzug, how does that sound to you?
That's very cute. That's that great song by Sandy Rapp. It's a great album that she's got on CD and on tape, which has some really terrific songs.
We only wish that Barbara Jordan could be enjoying it with you, too.
I wish you were. Yeah.
Well Bella, it doesn't look like that's happening in 1996,
no.
At least according to what we see in New York. Before we go on to the contract with women of the USA, can you give us a brief reaction to the primary yesterday here in New York? Does it mean anything to you? Senate Majority Leader Bob Dole sweeping New York, Forbes saying he's going to stay on to the end, Buchanan in there still as they head on to Super Tuesday.
Well, you know, the Republican Party's in disarray, and that's because their program is in disarray and their candidates are in disarray. I mean, you're going, you know, as I said, I pity the party in a sense that they've got Bob Dole, who was probably 22.6% stronger than Sominex. And they've had to reject Buchanan, who was represented ugly right-wing assault on all kinds of Americans in this country. And what's left is Forbes, who has a tax-saving plan that will, again, benefit the rich. So, I mean, I think they're in disarray, and there has been, as a result of all of this, a clear picture that the administration, with its programs, which it tries to address itself to people, will be reelected. I think that the Dole thing also shows the kind of control that the Republican Party exercised here by keeping other people off the ballot. And that's the kind of government they'll probably run, of control and right-wing major focus, which I think, unfortunately, Dole has allowed himself to yield to as well.
Well, let me ask you something before we go on to the contract with Women of the USA, and that is a question I've asked to a lot of people over the last few weeks. Do you think Buchanan is really the extremist here? Do you think that the Republican Party is successfully marginalizing him to make it look like they're a bit more moderate? Do you think Bob Dole is really that different?
No. I didn't say that. Quite the contrary. I'm saying that the Republican Party has allowed the right wing to dominate its party. It has constantly been moving the Republican Party further and further to the right. And the more Bob Buchanan has participated in this campaign, the more Dole himself is moving to the right, as the Republican Party has. They have not gotten control of their party any longer. And it's a very sad thing to see that, despite the fact that the people are now trying to reject Buchanan, that his focus is becoming a focus in the Republican Party itself. Takes the question of reproductive rights itself. People are afraid to even mention the fact that there's room for, as they say, or people of all points of view under the tent, but there is no room for a majority of the people in this country, for example, who believe in reproductive rights and Roe against Wade.
We're talking to Bella Abzug, and let me introduce her formally now, former U.S. Congresswoman, leading women's rights advocate, lawyer, public speaker, writer, organizer, co-chair of the Women's Environment and Development Organization, WEDO, an international network with consultative status at the United Nations. Bella, there's so much to talk with you about. You can give us real history and context that is so often lacking from the corporate network's coverage of politics in this day and age. But I want to focus specifically on something that's being released around the country now, and that is the contract with Women of the USA. Can you tell us how this came about and what it is you're calling for?
Well, actually, 188 countries, including plus the United States, approved an international platform for action in Beijing at the United Nations Fourth World Conference last September. The U.S. and many organizations made specific commitments. The U.S. pledged to advance women's lives in the areas of equality, power sharing, education, health, working rights, ending violence, promoting women-owned small businesses, etc. And though it's not legally binding, they were also inspired by 30,000 women who represented millions who were the non-governmental representatives at this conference. And it therefore was a large consensus agreement by all governments and so many thousands of women. And therefore, I suggested at the time that it was the world's contract with women. And so we're now releasing, the day being March 8th, International Women's Day, the beginning of a national grassroots mobilization campaign called the Contract with Women of the USA, just as there will be contracts with women of Bolivia, contracts with women in Nigeria, contracts with women in Italy, etc. This is basically a grassroots mobilization campaign to make women's concerns a central issue in policymaking and elections at the local, state, and federal levels. We are also working with the Center for Women Policy Studies on developing state contracts with state legislators who are adapting the contract to state concerns, and today already six or seven states and women legislators in six or seven states have announced their participation in the campaign and the development of state contracts that reflect local and state priorities. What does it all mean? Well, Newt Gingrich's contract with America has clearly run into stalemate and massive rejection by the American people. Our contract with Women of the USA reflects the realities and offers an alternative and unifying vision in which women and men can work together on an equal basis for our mutual benefit. It's been endorsed by more than 90 women's organizations just as a beginning, and we expect hundreds will be participating. It has also been endorsed by state and federal legislators and other individuals, and calls for a 12-point program of social and political equality for women, higher living standards, access to full reproductive rights and affordable health care, an end to discrimination and violence against women, and the dealing of sharing of responsibilities between the workplace and the family, and many issues which are dear and near to the needs of the majority of Americans in this country.
Talk a little about women as peacemakers.
Well, one of the, I think, outstanding things that took place at the Beijing was that there was, for the first time in international conferences, a recognition that what one of the important features that is missing at the peace table is the participation of women. You look at negotiating tables, you look at all kinds of conflicts that are taking place, you only hear from statespersons or military persons that are men. I think that there's such an imbalance in that, that finally it was recognized that if women were part of conflict resolution, as they are in many cases every day in their own lives, that there might be a difference. And so there's a big emphasis in the program adopted in Beijing of women as playing a role at places wherever the issues of peace are discussed. In other words, women are no longer just satisfied to be at the kitchen table. They want to be at the peace table. They also have to be at the table where economic decisions are made by world economic institutions like the World Bank. They want to be at the table at the United Nations. Unfortunately, there are only five ambassadors in the United Nations out of 189 countries who are women. They want to be presidents, cabinet ministers, and they want to be a lot more than 10% of the members of a Congress as they are in this country and most countries in the world.
Another plank of your program is educational equity, and maybe you can talk a little about that in relation to women and girls.
Well, I think that that it's important to understand that there is a tremendous problem about education in many ways, because the cultures of our society are obviously invading our areas of concern, and that it's important that we recognize that unless there is access, openness, an opportunity to participate equally on all issues that are available in an institution, educational institutions from the bottom to the top, that we will, you know, be making it increasingly difficult to improve the process of both men and women in what they have to accomplish in this country if they're not fully equipped and given the fullest possible opportunities.
We're talking with Bella Abzug, former Congress member and now head of WEDO, which is an organization called the Women's Environment and Development Organization. They've put out a contract with Women of the USA. And this
I don't like the way you say that. They put out a contract.
I didn't say contract on.
I know. Newt Gingrich's contract is a contract on.
Well, let me ask you this. Is the current administration, will President Clinton sign on to your contract with women?
Well, I don't, you know, we don't expect the president to sign on to a specific contract, but it's important to know that the issues in the contract many of which have already been seriously endorsed by this administration. As a result of the Beijing conference, a White House Council on Women to plan for the effective implementation of this platform of action has been set up. They've launched a six-year, $1.6 billion initiative to fight domestic violence and other crimes against women. In February, they announced a new 24-hour hotline run by them, a government on that. They're leading a call to the Department of Health and Human Services on AIDS, smoking, and breast cancer, conducting a grassroots campaign through the Department of Labor to improve conditions of women in the workplace, including working with employers to develop more equitable pay promotion policies, and helping employees to balance the twin responsibilities of family and work, taking steps to promote access to financial credit for women, to create micro-enterprise lending organizations, and to establish important initiatives to increase women's participation in the political process. I think that they've made a big commitment to the contract with American women, and I believe that steps that they're taking in their agencies, as I've described them now, regular reports of people and non-governmental organizations indicate a real commitment to these issues. Basically, they're fundamental issues of the nation. I mean, sharing family responsibilities, empowering women, affordable health care, reproductive rights, workplace rights, educational equity, in which it's important to create a gender-fair multicultural curricula and teaching techniques and equal opportunities. If we're to strengthen our nation, not only for women, but for men and women, ending violence, they're dealing very strongly with environment, and they recognize women as being an important factor in the results and the success of the nation.
Bella, today is International Women's Day.
That's
and
right.
You have been a major player on the world scene. I mean, a major force behind the fourth UN World Conference for Women in Beijing. Your international career is marked by being appointed by President Ford as congressional advisor to the U.S. delegation to the UN Decade of Women's International Women's Conference in Mexico City in 75. You played a major role in the decade conferences in Copenhagen and Nairobi, and it goes on from there. Here in the United States, there is very much, I think, in the mainstream political rhetoric, a feeling of isolation, of separating from the rest of the world. How did you end up broadening out to this international sphere? And what do you think of the atmosphere in this country today?
Well, I always felt, to begin with, that one couldn't really solve problems just individually. And so I always felt, and since I've been a youngster, actually a student, that we had to relate to what was first happening in our own government if we wanted to influence the course of government. I mean, I was a kid of the Depression. And when we went to college, we said, my God, we can't, you know, this can't go on. So we took a great interest in the development and the direction of government, and that has influenced me all of my life. But when I grew up, as we say, and became more and more involved in observing what the world was doing, I realized that you couldn't really solve problems just internally, either personally or even nationally, that there was a world out there. Particularly with the development of the atomic bomb, it became clear that we had to deal with problems on a world level, not just on a local level, and that policies were made that affected countries as well as individuals. And so I became aware of the fact, certainly with the atomic bomb and the nuclear testing that was affecting, bringing strontium 90 into the milk of our children, that we had to oppose these things. And I therefore became very involved in the peace movement in this country and on those issues, both as a private citizen and ultimately as a member of Congress, and later on as an activist in the international non-governmental movement in civil society. And that's the case today. I mean, the economy is globalized. Major decisions are made, not even by nation states, that affect the actual conditions of men and women, and especially women. Large capital projects that the World Bank and other institutions project are often at the sacrifice of the economic conditions of women. It's what we call a structural adjustment, which falls very heavily on women and poor people. And in this country, that's what's happening too. That kind of philosophy, that kind of theory internationally is affecting the methods that are being used in the Congress of the United States today to downsize, to downgrade, and to take away the safety nets and support in important programs such as, Medicare, Medicaid, environment, nutrition, earning some credit, and so on.
Bella,
and I think you can't solve these problems just in the country alone. And the United Nations is the only universal public authority in which all countries come together and can make decisions for mutual benefit, not only on issues of war and peace, but on issues of women's concerns, on issues of economic conditions, and on issues of reproductive rights.
And we're going to talk, Bella, we're going to talk more about international economic conditions. We're going to be going to Vandana Shiva in New Delhi, India, in just a minute. I want to thank you very much, former Congressmember Bella Abzug, woman of the world, and head of the Women's Environment and Development Organization here in New York. You can reach the Women's Environment and Development Organization, or WEDO. Their number is 212-759-7982. That's 212-759-7982. And you can also see the contract with Women of the USA on our website. We're putting it up there at www.pacifica.org. You're listening to Democracy Now! Stay with us. You're listening to Democracy Now! I'm Amy Goodman, Democracy Now!, Pacifica's national daily grassroots election show. Coming up in a little while, we'll be going to a Latina youth activist here in the city named Ana Maria Nieves. We very much look forward to that. But right now, sticking to the international theme on this International Women's Day, President Clinton and Republican candidate Bob Dole, the leading presidential candidates, are strong proponents of international trade agreements like NAFTA and GATT. One of a number of reasons that many feel the two corporate parties in this country, the Democrats and Republicans, have more in common than they disagree. On this International Women's Day, Vandana Shiva is the leading anti-GATT activist in India. And we're going to her in New Delhi. She's director of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy. Vandana Shiva, why don't you tell us, what does your group do?
Well, I resigned from university teaching in 1982 to start an independent research organization to do the research for movements that wasn't being done.
Why did you feel you had to leave academia to do that?
I had to do that because the big elite institutions are so enslaved to big money and big political power. They don't leave the freedom. They don't respect the freedom of individual researchers to serve the people, to work where knowledge is not married to power, but is actually married to the powerless. And I wanted that unusual class of marriage and to serve the powerless. And therefore, I had to do it in a space where that was respected, allowed, and had to create that space because it didn't exist.
Well, that certainly is a way to go into today's headlines. The merger of two mega drug companies, it's being called one of the largest mergers in the history of the world, and that is the merger of Ciba Geigy and Sandoz to form a mega conglomerate. What is your reaction to this?
The reaction basically is the recognition that no matter how big the giant corporations are, they are too small for the logic of growth. And therefore, they are in as much a struggle for survival as are the poor peasants and the tribals and the indigenous people and the poor blacks in downtown ghettos. They too are in a struggle for survival, and this is part of their struggle for survival, except that they're surviving in the environment of greed, whereas the rest of the world has to survive in an environment of need.
What does this kind of merger mean for the people that you work with?
The basic issue of the merger of these big companies, of course, relates to the kind of work I do, because there's no way you can separate a Sibagai in Sandoz from agriculture either. And I work in agriculture. The pharmaceutical giants are also becoming the chemical giants and the agricultural giants and the seed giants, requiring the new patent laws, requiring that the entire world be turned into their monopoly so that they can maximize their profits. The merger that was announced today shows us how desperate they are in terms of grabbing larger markets and having a larger control on resources. And part of that desperation is leading them to try and basically pirate the healing systems, the medicinal plants, the living diversity of this planet that has been the heritage of women healers, traditional Ayurvedic healers, Tibetan healers, and are just tinkering with that knowledge, prospecting for that knowledge, and rushing and patenting it. So on the one side, you're getting their largeness multiplied by the mergers. On the other side, you're getting their largeness multiplied by colonizing what have been the free spaces and free economies of people's self-reliant systems of food, nutrition, and healing.
Can you explain what you mean when you say they are patenting the remedies, for example, of women healers, etc.? What do you mean patenting, and how does it take it away from the people who originally use it?
Well, let me give you two examples of cases in which we have worked. The first, of course, is the big neem case, where neem, which is also a medicinal plant and a biopesticide, has been patented by chemical companies for its biopesticide use, by drug companies for its healing properties. There's also a plant called Philanthus niruri, which has been used in India for centuries for jaundice cure, by grandmothers, by mothers in the homes, by the poorest of women in slums, who know how to identify the niruri, how to make home-based medicine, give it to a child with hepatitis and jaundice, and it heals the liver. There's companies that now have patents for medicines derived from a medicinal plant, the use of which has been known for centuries. The way it affects the original users is first by denying their knowledge and their innovation. That's the first loss and the first piracy. The second loss is that the material that was going to heal the people by their having access to it gets diverted through tremendously huge collection systems in which these corporations can pay huge amounts to people to start collecting medicinal plants, so they disappear for the local community and are no more available. The third level, which is a later level, which I believe people have to fight against and not allow to be established, is these same companies will then make the drugs based on people's medicinal plants, package them, patent them, and flood the market with basically a solution that has come from the people themselves, and make people pay $100 for something that was absolutely freely available to them.
We're talking to Vandana Shiva, who is a well-known activist and researcher in India, as we talk about what the implications of drug mergers are and what it means when people who've been using remedies for centuries suddenly are, quote, discovered by larger entities like these corporations who want to patent this material for profit. Now, isn't there a suit going on in India right now against companies like these?
Not in India, because under our existing patent laws, and we have managed to ensure that those laws are not changed in a hurry, we have won major parliamentary battles on attempts at amending laws in favor of the transnationals and the corporations. According to our present laws, we cannot have products patented in the medicinal field. You can only have what are called process patents, which means methods of making medicines can be patented, but medicines themselves cannot be patented, so that you cannot exclude others from making the medicine in a different kind of way. These patents exist in other countries where they talk about stronger IPR systems, but there's no absolute way in which the intellectual property systems are strong or weak. They might be strong for the corporations, but then they're weak for the people. And when they're strong for the people, they're weak for the corporations. So the language and the adjective strong and weak systems that has been globalized has really been globalized from the perspective and interests of these giant corporations.
That's very interesting. I would think, and you are a well-known activist against GATT and these world trade agreements, that that kind of legal system you have in India would be considered, quote, GATT illegal. Is that true?
Absolutely. It would be considered GATT illegal, and we are basically committed to building a large enough national movement, and I think we've made some difference, that shows that GATT is morally illegal, economically illegal, health illegal, illegal in all the things that make life work.
Now, Vandana Shiva, the show that you're speaking on now, Democracy Now!, is a grassroots daily election show that goes out around the United States. President Clinton, who is also a presidential candidate, is extremely pro-GATT, pro-NAFTA, pro these world trade agreements. And so you explaining to us what GATT is and what it does for your country is very helpful in terms of people, you know, gaining information about what their candidates believe in, since it's often very tough to get that from corporate television here in the United States. Tell us about GATT.
The main thing about the new GATT, the Uruguay round of GATT, is that it converted everything into trade. But agriculture was not predominantly international trade. Intellectual property rights were not part of international trade. Services were not part of trade. Investment was not part of trade. And by enlarging the definition of trade and the scope of trade regimes, what has basically been done is a treaty has been made that on the one hand wipes out all public interest protection in all laws of every country. On the other hand, what it basically does is create a world constitution based on the logic of commerce, which can impose and intrude into domestic governance and basically make democracy impossible. Our struggles in India have been at the level of implementation of legislation that comes out of GATT. And every time GATT has to be implemented, something of our national constitution that is very fundamental to our survival, things like fundamental rights, the rights of farmers to have non-alienable rights to their land, to their seed, to their resources, the issue of self-reliance in food, all these basic national constitutional elements are dismantled to make the global commercial corporate constitution work. The GATT is basically the constitution of transnational corporations, and we are being asked, all of us are being asked to subject ourselves to it, give up our freedoms, give up our struggle for democracy. And I think at the end of the 20th century, that is too much to require of people. We cannot enter the next millennium as citizens enslaved to a handful of corporations.
How are you organizing against the General Agreement on Tariffs and Trade?
Well, we started organizing when the draft treaty was getting completed. It was called the Dunkel Draft Text, abbreviated as DDT, and we used to call it the toxic that is entering our systems and is going to poison us. Dunkel's name was so prevalent in every village because of the movements that were built. We started movements against patents. Just yesterday, I have had a huge democratic decision. We call them panchayats. Of local democratic units in India are called panchayats, local decision-making on the basis of consensus. We had what we call a mahapanchayat with about 100,000 farmers gathered in Delhi from across the country. And the two things we addressed were, firstly, how the transnationalized economy, the globalized economy in which corporations control the world and impoverish the local economy and the domestic economy, must necessarily create a politics, a political structure and politicians who are dependent on corporate kickbacks to make the electoral machinery run. And therefore, we have in India right now a massive corruption scandal linked to foreign companies trying to get deals in India, investments in power plants, Cargill, Continental trying to sell wheat. Just touch all the big names of the world. They have been responsible for inflating the corruption that already existed. And we've had about 15 ministers resign in the last 2 weeks because one citizen went to the Supreme Court with evidence to say that they had received kickbacks. And the entire system is now building towards a questioning by the people, saying, if representative democracy under transnationalized economies leads to this kind of corruption, we must take power back into the hands and rule locally, govern locally, have what we call Swaraj, our own rule. The second major issue we've been organizing around, and yesterday we had major resolutions passed on it, is we will not allow the entry of agribusiness into Indian agriculture. Indian agriculture employs 70% of India's large population. We are a small farmer-based agriculture, and we will not allow Cargill and PepsiCo to destroy the livelihoods of millions of farmers and turn them into GATT refugees. We will not allow Cargill and PepsiCo to desertify Indian soils. We will not allow KFC and McDonald's to convert every sacred cow of India into meat for the global markets.
Today is International Women's Day, Vandana Shiva, as I'm sure you well know. How does what you do, this work, relate specifically to women?
Actually, when I talk about agriculture, as far as talking goes, a lot of people have a misconception that in which case it's about men. Most farmers in India are women. And by the time you really get to working at the village level, whether it's seed conservation, a program I run now, as a response of a very interesting meeting I attended 10 years ago in France, where the corporations were meeting with activists. And at that point, I think it was the Sibagaigi representative who had said, by the turn of the centuries, there will only be five of us surviving. And in fact, this morning's merger signifies what they were foreseeing at that point. As a result of that meeting, I started a national program to conserve native seeds. And by the time you actually work on conserving native seeds, you do it with village women. You do it with peasant women. And peasant women are the biggest fighters against globalization in India. They are the ones fighting against the export of shrimp, the export of flowers. They are the ones who are setting up local resistance. And in my world, if you had to simplify the global politics right now, what we have is third world women producers pitted against the giant corporations which are capitalist patriarchal institutions.
Well, that certainly sums it up. We're going to have to wrap up, but I did want to ask, if people are interested in finding out more about your organization and the work that you're doing, how can they get in touch with you?
Well, they can fax us at 685-6795 at Delhi.
Let me just clarify for our listeners. The number, the fax number in New Delhi is 011-911-685-6795. That's 011-911-685-6795.
And for your women listeners, I would suggest that if they want to know more about GATT and if they want to see how it undermines the local democracy and if they want to ensure that that informed knowledge feeds into the forthcoming elections, which I believe no matter where in the world they are being fought, in India in April, in your country later in the year, they are a vote for a global corporate constitution versus national constitutions based on local democracy, then ring up. We do the WeDo offices in New York. I think you can get the names very easily because we prepared primers for WeDo to take to the Beijing conference for women. And I think that's the best International Women's Day gift that I could suggest to some of your listeners. to order these booklets and primers on GATT and World Trade Organizations and transnational corporations. Take them home and start the debates on democracy.
In fact, we just finished speaking with Bella Abzug, so we will give out that number again. I want to ask one last question, which is, are you at all concerned about the U.S. presidential elections? Are you watching them from your vantage point in India?
We are definitely watching them very, very carefully. And for, I think it's only the women who will be able to see that either the option of the Democrats that says World Trade Organization to be used in opportunistic ways by U.S. corporations, which is the Clinton stand, or no to the World Trade Organization by a Buchanan, who otherwise is willing to put the blacks and the women and the Mexicans behind him, locked into all kinds of ghettos, that we know that neither of those options is an option of democracy for us. For us, the option of democracy is local empowerment politically, options for livelihoods locally, equality in the race and the gender and the class level, and in religious sense. In India, your debate is very important because as a result of the movements we have created, we actually got a right-wing economist to write that Swadeshi, which means in India an economy based on India's strength, our local skills and knowledge, that Swadeshi is equal to Buchanan. And I have to do this on Sunday. I have to write a response and say, no, Swadeshi is equal to Gandhi.
Vandana Shiva, happy International Women's Day.
The same to you.
Vandana Shiva is the leading anti-GATT activist in India. She is director of the Research Foundation for Science, Technology, and Natural Resource Policy. We were just speaking to her in New Delhi, India. You're listening to Democracy Now! Coming up next, a Latina youth activist from Harlem and the Bronx. After this. You're listening to Democracy Now!, Pacifica's national daily grassroots election show. I'm Amy Goodman. Do the names Clara Zetkin and Louise Zeitz sound familiar to you? Well, they should. They're basically the founders, the movers and shakers behind International Women's Day, which is today. And it was originally set up to focus on female and child labor and the 10-hour day for all workers, celebrated first here in the United States in 1909. Celebrated by socialists here in the United States. Coming up next, we turn to a local activist here in New York, and we're broadcasting out of Pacifica's station in New York, WBAI, for the New York primary. We're joined by Ana Maria Nieves. She is a Latina youth activist from Harlem and the Bronx, and she has an amazing story to tell. Ana Maria, thanks for joining us.
Absolutely.
Well, why don't you tell us a little about your life. You're 25 years old. Tell us about what happened before you became an activist, and just give us a picture of where you were born and things that happened after that.
Well, I was born in the Bronx. I was born to parents, a father who was a drug addict and a mother who was a schizophrenic who lived in an institution. Because of that, I was put into the court system and put through the foster care system. And I spent some time in the foster care system. And then my father became brilliant. He realized that I could be money to him. And he was able to get me back from the courts. He went to court, proved that he was drug-free, you know, the same thing of switching your urine and all that stuff. Proved he was drug-free, got me back. And I think that's what started the era of my anger. I lived with him for a number of years. In those numbers of years, he rented me to couples who wanted to pretend like they had children of their own. Thanks to him, I have traveled for free to many places.
Why did they want to pretend they had kids of their own?
I believe I was very young and didn't ask many questions, but I believe because they couldn't have children of their own. I went to Georgia. I grew up. I was raised in Boston, Georgia. I went to Puerto Rico for a time and to Mexico and just to different couples here in the city. And I got to experience many things, some things good, some things bad. But eventually my father got even smarter and he realized that I could be more money to him if he put me on his welfare budget. And I lived with him through my junior high school years. And I think that was definitely the time of what I consider hell. He took the welfare check, the food stamps, cashed them in for cash, and he would use that for crack, his next hit. He would sell my food, my clothes, my book bag, and that went on for a long, long time. During that time, my job as part of this two-person family was to make sure that his life was going okay. So that meant when he rented the bedroom for couples to have sex, that meant cleaning the cum-stained sheets. When he rented the bathroom from drug dealers to use, that meant cleaning the blood when a person misshot off the shower curtains or the toilet. And it meant collecting his money for him so that if he was ever stopped on the streets from selling drugs, that he wouldn't be sent to jail. So he made me part of the process. And I also got to, grow up pretty quickly because he would leave the home weeks at a time out on the streets on Jerome Avenue, and I would be home taking care of myself. I would work, I would clean houses after like parties and go to school full time, work at the supermarket or the local bodega to make money. Our rent was only $99 because of Section 8, but I think for a 14-year-old, that's still a lot of money.
So here you were living your life in the way you've just described. You weren't exactly a community organizer like you are today. What changed for you and what gave you hope?
It all really changed when I moved in with a man. I guess he was 19 at the time, so I guess a young man, who seemed like he was the way out. He met me when I was living with my father and became really concerned about how I was living. And he sort of moved in. My father wasn't there all the time anyway, so he moved on the living room couch. He bought me a microwave for my room, and he bought me my school books, and he bought me my clothes, and he bought me a lock to put on my bedroom door, the same you would have on your outside door. And he took care of me. And then my father threw him out one day, and I packed my clothes underneath his and never came back home, and I moved in with him. And I stayed with him for 6 years, and at the time when I moved in with him, he, I guess to me, was a father figure, but I guess he saw it as more than that, and he started asking me for payback, and I spent 5 of those 6 years being raped constantly and hit when I didn't want to be raped. And as part of from that, and just I really felt like that was it. I couldn't deal with it anymore. It had been almost all of my life, and I felt like, you know, if you can take what you think is yours, I can definitely take what's mine. And I tried to commit suicide on a number of occasions. I was tired of the abortions. I was tired of the police that just came to the door and just didn't care, even though he came to the door bloodied from all the scratches. And he wouldn't let me commit suicide. He would constantly hide the pills from me, constantly watch me. So I figured the way to do it was to pretend like I was looking for a better life so he wouldn't be concerned anymore. So I went to an organization, which unfortunately was in a totally different borough from the one I lived in because we didn't have the resources in the community I lived in. And I went to get my GED. And they tricked me. They basically said, if you join our GED program, you have to join this leadership program. And that's where I met other young people that were going through the same thing that I was going through. It's like, you know, I didn't feel alone anymore. It definitely was like it. And what's sad to say is that my story wasn't an isolated story. And there were lots of other young people. And instead of saying, I'm tired of it, and I can't deal with it anymore, looking for a way out, they were saying, I'm tired of it, I can't deal with it, and I'm going to do something about it. And that just really, I couldn't believe that there was a room full of 40 young people going through the same thing, on different levels, going through the same thing, and they were angry as I were. And I was just thinking, wow, this is how movements are started. We can do it right here in this room. And that just totally inspired me. And from there, I went crazy.
Okay, tell us about it. Tell us about what you did.
I felt so just like inspired. I couldn't believe the power in that room. I started reading history books and all about the 60s and the civil rights movement. And I was dreaming, you know, maybe I was meant to be a civil rights activist and be out there and on counters and in rally lines. And I just looked for every single way that I could possibly be involved in such a thing. And I joined every youth group. I joined a lot of youth councils within New York City government. So I basically, like, I showed up at a meeting, and you know how they go around and you do introductions, and I was like, hi, my name is Ana Maria Nieves, and I'm from the Bronx, and I'm from Urban X, Youth Uprising, I'm from Jobs for Youth, I'm from 21st Century Leadership, I'm from the Major Advisory Council, and I went on and on and on and on. I just joined every possible thing I could I wanted to have an effect. I wanted to be able to change the lives of young people that were going through the things that I was going through, and to let them not get to the point of where they wanted to try to commit suicide.
Tell us about Urban X.
Urban X was founded in 1991. We were founded because we were at a youth rally. We were asked to organize this youth rally of a larger youth conference. And at this youth conference, there was a whole panel of police officials. And young people came up and basically just said what they felt about police officers in their community. So we said, well, since we organized this, of course, you know, we manned the mics. We felt at the end we could at least say what we felt. So we basically presented the truth. We feel that that police officers should represent our community, should come from our community. They should go through youth sensitivity training because they obviously can't relate to us. They can't communicate with us. If you have to move us off our own street corners, it's not our fault we don't have parks to hang out at. And you obviously don't understand that, so you must be coming from some utopia. You must live in Norfolk or Sussex County. So we said those things, and unfortunately, the organizations that we were working with were trying to receive funding from the police department and felt that we jeopardized their chances of getting funding by offending the police department. At the time, even Police Commissioner Lee Brown was on the panel, and they were very upset with us, and they threatened to fire us. And some of us, you know, were teen parents. Some of us paid our own rents and really couldn't afford to lose the money. And so we said, okay, we're not going to shut up. We've learned that there's other ways, so how else can we do this? And we said, well, let's create our own organization. That way, the next time we say something, I can say, I'm Ana Maria Nieves from Urban X, and this is what I think, and not worry about a paycheck since we don't get funded by anybody.
And so that's how Urban X was born?
Yes, that's how we started.
Now, you're a part of Urban X and also something called Do Something?
Mm-hmm. Do Something is, Urban X is the radical side of me. Since we don't get funded, I get to do anything that basically can tick a lot of people off, but is the truth. Do Something is a safer side, but it's also an important side. It's a national organization. We work on providing resources providing resources for young people and training young people to improve their communities. Our goal is to make every city in the United States a better place to live. And we're starting in Boston, Newark, Selma, and D.C. And in part of providing resources, we actually, I'm really happy to announce, kicked off a new project on January 29th, where we're looking for the top 10 young people in the U.S., the top 10 young people that are really doing amazing, amazing things to improve their community. And the top winner, must be under 30, the top winner will receive $100,000, and the nine runners-up will receive $10,000 each to continue their work. So it's definitely a great opportunity to be at Do Something and to be part of. Just, I'm so excited about being able to say to somebody, you've won $100,000 to just make your community an amazing place.
We're talking with Ana Maria Nieves from Harlem and the Bronx. your community organizer, UrbanX, Do Something, or your groups. What about the presidential election? You're 25 years old. You can vote. Have you been voting?
Oh, absolutely. Ever since I was 18. You kidding me? I registered when I was 17, and I was ready. I was ready with my card. I was proud of it. And I was definitely at the booths at 18.
In what way could someone like Bill Clinton or Bob Dole or Buchanan or someone else that we hear about every day, the major contenders in the Democratic and Republican primaries, make a difference in your life?
That's a very good question. I definitely think that the presidential elections are very, very important. And to answer your question, I think Dinkins demonstrated it very well, and that's by making youth part of their platform. Right now, the hottest ticket is domestic violence, and you hear a lot of candidates addressing making the world a safer place for women because of OJ. You'll hear a lot about taxes because that affects another population that votes for them, and that's the upper class. But unfortunately, youth under 18, and that's, I mean, they kind of forget about the 20-somethings, but youth under 18 can't vote. And so it doesn't become part of that platform. It's not important anymore. But one thing that I always remind young people and politicians whenever I can speak to them here in New York City is, you know, you can't forget about us. I mean, we may be under 18 now, but we're watching you. We are on your tails, and we are looking out for everything that you're doing. And we're not be able to vote you in because we're not 18. But when we hit 18, we'll be able to vote you out. If you look at the statistic, the largest gap in voting is between 18 and 22. That's the largest population that does not vote. And with great mobilization around the country, young people can vote someone out with those numbers.
We're talking to Ana Maria Nieves, and we do have to wrap up. I was first drawn to your story, first noticed it in Ms. Magazine when they named you one of the Women of the Year, Women to Watch. They began your story by talking about how you go into high schools and what you say to high school students. Why don't we end with that?
I guess that's my philosophy and how to get involved. And a lot of young people say, well, you know, I don't understand, how do I get started? Or youth directors say, I don't understand how to get my young people motivated. And I think the trick is to find out what makes them angry. It's to really tap down and figure out what the hell makes you sick. Sick to your stomach that you just want to vomit, puke, whatever the word you choose. And that's where you need to get started, because that's what you're most passionate about, and that's what it takes.
Well, Ana Maria Nieves, thank you very much for joining us. How can people get in touch with you and your organization, UrbanX, or Do Something?
For Do Something, you can call 212-523-1175. For the Brick Award application that we're giving out for the $100,000, you can go to any Blockbuster video store. Hmm. It's in Mademoiselle magazines, or look on MTV for PSAs, and there's a 1-800 number. For UrbanX, you can call 212-281-3460, and because we're not funded, it's just a voicemail. We're not manned in terms of an office yet, but we certainly will get back to you within a day.
Well, thank you for gracing our studios this morning.
Thank you for having me.
Ana Maria Nieves, 25 years old, community organizer. You've been listening to Democracy Now!, and you can get a copy of this tape by calling our Pacifica archives at 1-800-735-0230. That's 1-800-735-0230. You can also write to us at our email address. It's democracy@pacifica.org. That's democracy@pacifica.org. We also have a website, and that address is www.pacifica.org. That's www.pacifica.org. And don't forget that conversation with Bella Abzug earlier and the contract with Women of the USA. You can see that contract on our website. And you can also call WEDO. That's the Women's Environment and Development Organization here in New York, Bella's organization, at 212-759-7982. That's 212-759-7982. Well, that's it for another edition of Democracy Now! Democracy Now! Is produced by Julie Drizin. It was directed out of our studios here in New York at WBAI by Errol Maitland. Our engineer has been Bernard White. Tune in next week for another edition of Pacifica Radio's national daily grassroots election show, Democracy Now. I'm Amy Goodman.